You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, a very special bonus episode covering our favorite films of 2025, featuring ping pong, car chases, fascist regimes, Big Nick, Irish vampires, bone temples, girl dads, grave robbing, art heists, death dreams, open mics, endless baseball, and Neil Diamond. Martin.
Yes.
No fear. Just like Tom fucking Cruise. Edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining us as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, 2025, not too bad of a year for movies.
I honestly can't remember a better year in recent memory since COVID.
It's certainly been the best year since COVID. That's the thing is, and I've seen some other people try and argue that it was like a touch back heavy, where like we kind of went through a fallow period in the early part of 2025, and then everything really started dropping. But I mean, like, I would argue against that because I mean, at least one in my top five that we're about to cover came from, I think, the first week in January.
And one of mine is, like, the first month, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I think they're pretty equally distributed. But either way, even if it came out in a concentrated form, is like, we had to whittle down a master list that I've been keeping all year on my phone that's roughly like, I want to say up to like 29 movies now. And I mean, in the average year, I don't think I have even that many on like an honorable mention.
Well, I remember like, again, thinking back to COVID days, like I think it was 2021 when we did this episode.
Right.
I was like scraping the bottom of the barrel to think of five.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen a lot that year. There wasn't a lot of great stuff to see. And I just didn't go to the theater a lot. I feel like we were all still in that post kind of COVID, like,
this is one of the first years, I think also due to some like personal stuff that happened in my life too, is that like, I think this is one of the first years where I've been like fully back at the movies.
Yeah.
I'm back collecting Blu-rays. I'm going to all the press screenings. We're seeing stuff in IMAX and everything together. We're going to rep screenings together. Like it is, I think, the first one since 2020 that feels full on, like, we're back in movie mode. We've got writing on the site. Like, things are just happening all again.
Yeah, it's really exciting because, like, I think it started probably, not to speak for you, but we were talking early in the year of, like, this is already a great year for horror.
Right.
And it started that way where it was like, wow, there's a lot of good genre stuff coming out. And I felt, and I know a lot of horror people would agree, it's like the best in recent memory.
A long while.
And then you start to get these, you know, big, huge movies. Like, I think Sinners is where the year really turned, because that was such a, I haven't seen a movie take a hold of the culture so completely. Honestly, it reminded me of like Barbenheimer. It was that level of like the memification.
Well, and that's what I was going to jump in and say too, is that it's like, this is the first year probably since Barbenheimer where like I feel like there were consistent blockbusters too.
Yep.
Because like Sinners is a good kind of point of demarcation, we'll say, like you kind of pointed out, to where it's like this is where the year really kind of turned up.
Yeah.
Because right after that you have F1 too.
Yep.
Which is huge. And like F1 was also one of those big buzzy productions where like, you know, people were talking about the budget and it was ballooning up to like $300 million and nobody knew if it was going to do great. But man, we went to that influencer screening and like that movie blew the fucking roof off. And then it became this huge international hit too. Yep. That's kind of run away and is now even still kind of competing in Oscar talks. And I think that's one of the main reasons too that like I got back into full like movie mode this year is that like this is the first year that feels not just distributed throughout the year, but like distributed through all forms and like levels of productions to where like we have some great blockbusters, we have some great foreign language stuff, we have some great smaller budget movies that we've seen. Like there's one that's probably not going to make either one of our lists that we both like totally flipped out for, which was Strange Harvest.
Oh my God. Found
footage horror, like slasher movie, yeah, true crime thing that like is really indescribable and kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's a really special movie.
And we stumbled upon that, but I mean, that's not even going to make our list, but that was also another thing that we totally flipped for. And that's on like the lowest end of like budgeted movies. And it looks incredible.
Yeah, it was. Well, and it felt like a year. And I think like you said, this whole podcast is tied in with like our personal lives as well. And like, I feel like when my life is going better, I'm liking movies more.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that's like, but like you and I are both in, I think, a pretty good place in our lives right now.
Yeah.
You know, like we're in relationships.
We're both settled down.
We're both in relationships with like people we love, and like it changes your view of everything. And like, so you're kind of like, oh, wait, I'm safe now. I can like go see movies. I can buy stuff. Like I'm financially secure, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, not to get too personal here, but I think that you have also a feeling of, in a time where they say the movie star is dead and it's all about IP and we're all, obviously AI is just the big elephant in the room this whole year when it comes to production, the strikes last year, everything, right? And to see these films come out that are so huge and a lot of times like star-driven projects, we have F1, we've got One Battle After Another, and we got Marty Supreme.
I mean, even Sinners that you brought up, you have a dual role for Michael B. Jordan.
Exactly, you know.
And, I mean, arguably the biggest blockbuster director. Well, two of the biggest blockbuster directors. You have Kaczynski on F1, and then you have Ryan Coogler making this huge personal sort of horror movie project.
Well, you're right, because it is also cool to see these two guys who have broken out. You think about the size of and the success of Black Panther that shot out from the noise of Marvel, and people, I think even by 2018 were like, eh, and then that comes out and just like blows the roof off.
That was a game changer like during that time period for the MCU.
Right. And it was like months before
In Creed before that.
Well, in Creed, yeah. And he just shows he's got his bona fides. And then you have Kaczynski who's, you know, coming off of Maverick,
yeah,
which also was, people thought that kind of block, also that was right after COVID, that the blockbuster was dead, shows the strength of Tom Cruise and also that kind of real filmmaking.
Well, it's still touted as the movie that saved movies,
yeah,
you know, in movie theaters.
And 100%. And F1, for him to not only do it again, but like, I kind of like it more than Maverick, like in a lot of ways. I think
that's insane talk. I will get to F1 here in a second.
Yeah.
But like, let's not put the cart before the horse.
I should
Maverick's
calm down.
Fucking Maverick.
I got excited.
It's all right. But I mean, like, to take it to another step further is that we also had you, me, and our buddy Shapiro, who was just on our Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair episode that went up a couple days ago, is that we talk about offline filmmakers as brands, too.
Yes.
And so, like, Coogler now is his brand. I think, like, Kaczynski's pretty close,
yeah,
when it comes to, because now if you just put from the director of Top Gun Maverick and F1, like, people are going to sign up. Like, he's doing Miami Vice next.
Yes.
So, like, sure, yep, give it to me.
Which I'm very cool with.
But, I mean, like, there's also these guys who are coming through and making movies who you recognize on like a smaller level. Like, you got an Ari Aster movie this year, and mm-hmm, he's like the A24 horror guy, you know, next to Robert Eggers. Although Eggers is now kind of broken out of that A24 mold and is making like bigger budget movies. You have a Danny Boyle movie coming back. You have two Safdie brothers movies coming in, and those guys have become brand names in their own right, especially since they're split. You have a Paul Thomas Anderson movie on like the biggest budget possible, his biggest scale that he's ever made. You have, you know, you have a David Cronenberg movie. You have some late style, like, I mean, we also have the James L. Brooks movie, which we're not going to cover at all. Ella McKay.
Right.
Which, have you seen that yet?
I will not. I have not.
Absolute disaster.
No, I've heard it's like pretty bad.
Yeah, it's atrocious. And like the weird attempts to already reclaim the movie by like I know Sean Fantasy got into some trouble because on the big picture, he called any attempts at reclaiming that movie, I think it was irony poisoned millennial bullshit.
Fair.
And it really is, because like you watch it and you're like, this is indefensible. Like it's just an absolute piece of shit. But it is, if anything, a work of late style, what we've now known as late style from James L. Brooks. And also apparently it was part of a bartering ship that he had, I think, with Fox to make the next Simpsons movie. Is that he basically was like, yeah, I'll help you get the Simpsons movie made and even help with making it as long as I get to make Ella McKay, which, you know, whatever.
Cool.
But the thing is, across the board, we have these name brand filmmakers getting to work on these projects that, like, for all of them, like, Eddington is a radical movie.
Yes.
Like, whether you love it or hate it, like, that is, you only get to make that if you're Ari Aster. And you only get to make that if you had, you know, Midsommar and Hereditary under your belt as these huge art house hits. You know, you only get to make The Shrouds if you're David Cronenberg. You know, so like, and only David Cronenberg could make that movie. You know, you only, it is kind of crazy now that like Josh Safdie's getting to make $70 million like period pieces about ping pong. Like that movie, I don't know where that came from.
Yep.
But like Paul Thomas Anderson, you kind of only get to make one battle after another after you've elevated to this status of like legendary auteur.
Yes. Yeah. And then you get, again, while we're seeing a second, you know, it's kind of the death of the movie star, like Leo still brings a lot of clout with him. And
he's still the GOAT.
And he's still the GOAT. And so like they know on the awards level, they're going to be locked in. And then it turned in like, probably the best move, one of the best top two movies of the year.
Right.
You know,
which that's a good segue here, because we're going to break down how we're going to actually gonna do this, is that we kind of stole a format. I was listening to The Watch lately, and they did something on their podcast that I really liked, is that Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald had a shared top five TV shows of the year, but then they each brought their own top fives that kind of was more tailored to their individual tastes, but kind of like what we're talking about with movies is they were like, there's five movies that were just like, these are, or there's five TV shows for them that they're like, these are the bangers. They're kind of like, you know,
indisputable.
Yeah. Indisputable.
Yeah.
And now we're, instead of just basically having all this overlap on our lists, let's do our own thing and then just come together with one master one, which is what we did as well. So do you want to go first with your first pick?
Yeah. So for my personal pick.
Your personal pick. Yes, sir.
So I'm going to go number one is going to be Bring Her Back.
Good movie.
Gnarly
movie.
Gnarly movie. And this was just a, like, I did not love Talk to Me.
Me either.
Yeah, I think
I like it.
No, I do too. And actually rewatching it after Bring Her Back, I like it a lot more. But I think that like a lot of times I get annoyed by horror discourse and people just flip for movies. And it's like, this is the greatest, most fucked up thing since forever. I'm like, okay. Like, and it just wasn't for me. And I liked the mythology of Talk to Me. This one, Bring Her Back, I actually really wasn't excited for it. I was not a big fan. And I was a Thursday, and it was the opening. So it was a Thursday, and we had a huge rainstorm in Austin. And, you know, my partner Val, she was supposed to work, but she has her own hair salon, and all of her clients canceled because they're like, we're not driving in the rain. And she's like, well, I got a
typical Austin.
She's like, seriously. She's like, I got a snow day. I said, well, I was going to go to an early screening of Bring Her Back, like, do you want to go? And she's like, yeah, sure.
Oh,
and,
my God, what a midday date movie that was.
But it's like her favorite movie of the year, too. Like, oh, really? She was like, we got done, and she had this look on her face, and I'm like, did you like it? And she's like, oh, my God, I loved that movie. And I think what was really, what's great about the film, just because, you know, we were talking offline of, you know, I'm writing this movie, I'm trying to make it myself as well, and a similar thing of, you know, one location, like really kind of locked room.
That's a great house in that one.
Great house. And a mystery box kind of narrative, mm-hmm. right? Of like the kind of what's in the basement, what's really going on here, or what's in the greenhouse. And the way it doles out the information, while there are some holes in the mythology.
I was going to say, this actually is a atypical pick for you because you usually like everything sort of airtight in the explanation for things. And this is very much, this yada yada's a lot of shit.
It really does. And I think it also gave me hope that, like, I'm trying to work on my own stuff where I was like, it works because of that, because I think there's enough detail to kind of put A plus B equals C in the movie. And I love, and just for me, it's Sally Hawkins. Like,
she's terrific.
That you have a really well-written main character that she knocks completely out of the park as this, like, I've never seen a horror villain like her, because Sally Hawkins brings with her a feeling of, I like her immediately. Like, she's a likable person since, like, Happy Go Lucky up through Shape of Water. Like,
yeah.
If she's on screen, you're like, I'm rooting for her. But the way that she, you know, plays that to an evil degree, and the way she's using that to hide what her true mm-hmm. her true plans toward these kids is amazing. And then, like, it's just a really, really, really disturbing horror film. Like, there are two scenes with mouth stuff.
Whoa.
That yeah, is really, and then, I mean, people still talk about it. Like, that's one of the, I think it's one of the scenes of the year, is the knife, chewing on the knife.
Yeah, it's,
and they, because you have the scene in Talk to Me, the kid's bashing his head against the table, and it's like, they definitely are, like, messing up kids' faces for horror. I'm like, it's effective. It's so disturbing. Like, yeah.
But we're the first one has more Sam Raimi energy. This is closer to, like, French New Extremity, which how sad and fucked up it is.
No, it's not far off from Martyrs in terms of that feeling of also there's a reason, like, there's a philosophy behind what's happening, which makes it scarier.
Yeah.
You know, because she's, you also believe, it has a very truly haunting final shot.
Yeah.
Too, where you, because you really are like, I get why she's doing what she's doing. I don't want to give too many spoilers of people. I do recommend it. It's my favorite film and horror film of the year.
Yeah.
Absolutely just knocked it out of the park.
So my first pick is going to be The Secret Agent, Kleber Mondanco Filhos. I apologize if I just butchered your name, sir. I know you're listening. His follow-up to Baccarat, which was kind of the Brazilian acid western from a couple years ago that I really, really liked. The Secret Agent is just a level up in every single way. Wagner Moura plays a scientist who's basically trying to get out of the country after some industrialists, you know, are coming after him. And it really is about existing inside of a fascist regime, because it takes place in 1977 in Brazil, a time of great mischief, as the opening title card tells us. And it's literally about a guy trying to get him and his son out of the country and moving through these very clandestine villages in Brazil and finding other revolutionaries like him. It's one of the great kind of unified works of the year, is I think one of the things we didn't talk about when talking about why 2025 was such a terrific and an inspiring year for movies, is that it's also one of the first years that's felt political in a way,
mm-hmm.
and responsive to what's currently happening in the world and specifically in the United States. That's a lot of people responding to fascism and existing under fascist regimes, and The Secret Agent is not the best work of it. There's obviously one on our shared list and probably most people's shared list that is in the same spirit as this movie. But there's also a second layer to it, is that it becomes about a guy who's trying to preserve and reclaim his own history, because, you know, in Brazil at that time, you're going through a massive disappearances where, you know, these regimes could just basically erase you from the planet if they didn't like you, and erase any trace of your existence, and it's about one man researching his mother's existence and trying to make sure that that's preserved, and then also he and his son's existence being preserved at the same time. But it's also this crazy ode to movies, because it all takes place in these old movie palaces where they hide out, where, you know, the his son's grandfather is the lead projectionist in the 70s, and like he's projecting all these movie these classic 70s movies. Like, it all revolves around the release of Jaws and The Omen and things like that. And you're seeing them play in the background and the posters for them and stuff. Oh, that's so cool. And it's just like how movies also became a refuge during this time and an inspiration during this time. And I just think nothing really speaks to our current climate quite like The Secret Agent. It's just one of the great movies of the year. And I can't wait for people, more and more people, to discover it as it keeps getting rolled out by Neon. I know it's going to get a huge awards push. Wagner Moura is probably going to be up for Best Actor for it, because it's a total movie star performance. Yeah. He's incredible in this fucking movie. And, like, I just can't recommend it, you know, high enough. Like, I can't wait for it to enter the public consciousness a little more than it already has. And to be fair, it is a pure art movie. It's almost 3 hours long. It's languid. There's not a ton of like propulsive narrative. You kind of just hang out inside of it. So I get why some people are rejecting it. But like, if you really vibe with it and you get into that world and just kind of let yourself sink into it, I think people will really fall in love with it. So what's your next pick?
My next pick is Predator Badlands.
Good movie.
I love Dan Trachtenberg so fucking much. Like,
like this movie more than I do, and I quite enjoyed it.
Well, because you saw it before I did, and you're like, this is great, but I think you knew I was going to probably like it more. Again, this is a huge, very big blockbuster. It's in an IP, but here's this guy since Prey, and also Killer of Killers, the animated anthology he did, which also fucking rules.
Which is, this is much more of a companion piece with, like, they feel more related than Prey, you know?
Well, yeah, and I think that a lot of people were, I understand some people were turned off by Predator Badlands because it was a lot of the fandom saying,
it's PG-13.
It's the Marvel-ication, or, you know.
Which it is. Oh, it's basically the Guardians of the Galaxy-ification of the Predator franchise.
100%. And I'm honestly, like, not a huge James Gunn fan. So it's, and he didn't make this film, but, like, you made the point. There's so, the humor and everything is so tied to that.
The found family kind of elements of it.
Yes. But it's, what I love about the movie is, like, what it captures and retains from Prey is this like brutal primal feel, that while he has these futuristic weapons, it's like pure survival. And like, for me, Trachtenberg is one of the best working action directors in Hollywood right now.
He's tremendous.
Because there's the scene toward the end where he goes full primal and he basically builds his Predator suit out of, like, you know, bone, and like, he, instead of his shoulder blaster, it's like an acid spitting fucking snake or eel.
He gets the Arnold gear up moment from the first movie. They just retool it to where the Predator is the good guy.
No, 100%. And like, again, that's a really good point, because I think a lot of times you and I and a lot of fans roll our eyes at like the, you know, Force Awakens way of like, we're just going to give you what you want, right? It's just going to be the beat for beat.
Sure.
You know, but this is like, it's, he remixes it in such a way that it goes down easy.
Well, I also think it's the difference between having someone like J.J. Abrams do it, who's a pretty crass capitalist, and he's a company man who's going to approach it for, like, this is what's going to make the most money.
Right, pure pastiche.
Exactly, where Trachtenberg is, like, you can tell he just enjoys, like, playing in this sandbox.
Yes.
Like, he was great with Prey. He understood, like, the essence of the Predator character. He knew, you know, that... I wrote this on Letterboxd, like, a while ago when Prey came out, but I hold firm to it, is that the Predator's almost, like, the greatest pro wrestler of all time.
Mm.
And so much of it is just throwing him in an arena with a different opponent, is that it's, like... here comes a Predator versus Commandos versus here comes a Predator versus Drug Lords. Now it's like
a Predator versus cops.
And here comes a Predator versus a Native American warrior. And it's like all you have to keep doing. And Killer of Killers does a very similar thing. It's literally just those scenarios over and over again. It's just introducing him as the big heel versus your hero character. And like in here, this is almost like the heel turn. To where it's like you actually get in pro wrestling, he's finally the good guy.
Right.
So Trachtenberg is just like, and he obviously just loves existing inside of this world and just letting the Predator go completely batshit. Because the one thing you haven't really mentioned is that this is almost an animated movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's almost no human actors in it besides Elle Fanning, who's awesome.
Right.
In it, but she's like the Rocket Raccoon of the movie.
Yep.
And then
mixed with like Nebula.
Yeah. And once they introduce like the twin idea behind it and like, cause then it becomes like Gamora and Nebula.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like,
oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Mantis, but she's like Mantis in her.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very cute. Yeah.
But like, she's having a lot of fun. And then, but like, he literally is like, what if we just made the Predator, the good guy, and put you in the environment that he's already pretty comfortable in and going on this big hunt with. And like, it's just awesome. It's a great monster movie.
Yeah. And it's I really compared it to, I think there's Cameron elements. Obviously it's also the Weyland-Yutani world of aliens, but I think what Trachtenberg has that Cameron also, when he's at his best, is the sense of raising the stakes continuously throughout the film. Like you, when you're sitting comfortably in a movie like that, you're like, wow, that scene was awesome. And it's only going to get better from here. And he keeps making it bigger and cooler. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's that kind of like you're on a good.
Sure. I'm waiting for you to finish because I'm going to throw some bait out for you. Some chum into the water.
But we'll throw it.
Is Predator Badlands a better James Cameron movie than Avatar Fire and Ash?
Yes.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. No.
I know you definitely enjoyed it more.
I enjoyed it more. I think that, and spoiler alert, Avatar Fire and Ash is on none of our lists this year.
Still pretty good.
Still pretty good. It was high.
And you like it more than I do.
And Way of Water was high on when we did this in 2022.
Yeah.
For our 2022 year, because that's one of my favorite movies of that year. And it was like that and Maverick, I think, were our one and two.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, that's, I don't want to rip on, I don't want to spend time ripping too much on Avatar Fire and Ash, but like, also, as a storyteller and as a tight, like, as an action blockbuster storyteller, Trachtenberg does understand, like, again, when Cameron's at his best of setting up a world, throwing you into it, and then just, like, revealing more and more until a huge, climactic, really satisfying ending when he goes full, like, commando, then the final fight with the giant, like, walker thing. It's just like, come on, man.
Yeah.
It's just sci-fi.
It's incredible.
It's amazing.
So my second pick is going to be a movie you absolutely hated, Eddington, mm-hmm. by Ari Aster. This was early on in the year one of my contenders for my favorite film of the year. I remember when I saw it the first time, I remember texting you and Shapiro and being like, I love this. And then you both were like, go figure.
I mean, it's the least surprising thing of the year that's happened to me.
But I maintain that this is Aster's best movie thus far. It's his meanest and ugliest movie thus far. And I think in a year that sees a lot of people making movies about revolution and a reaction to existing inside of Trump's America and fascism and techno bros like running wild, Aster almost feels like the apathetic version of it,
right,
where he's just like, we're fucked, there's nothing we can do, the forces of darkness.
The nihilistic
like, guess what, you can exist inside of this, but eventually it's going to come for you all and you're all going to die and like the world's the dumbest place ever, which, you know, is basically my worldview too. So I loved it. I think it's one of Joaquin's best performances. He's absolutely hysterical in it. It has one of Aster's best set pieces, one of his most like shocking, upsetting moments of like graphic violence I've seen in any of his movies, and which is saying something because he's known for that at this point. And also, it's just fucking hilarious. Like, there are some truly hysterical moments. Like, the whole showdown over turning down Katy Perry's firework is hysterically funny. But you are not a fan of this.
No. I.
No.
Well, it's pretty funny. I remember because I was late to the party. You and James had already seen it. And I went to the Galaxy with Val to see it. And I was like, dude, I got to see it. Like, I'm also not a monster Ari Aster fan, period. And no. So I was like, I got to go.
Which, to be clear, I'm not really either.
Well, I know you're not, but I'm like really not. Yeah. And so I was like, I'm just whatever. And so we go. And I'll say one thing. He's a very good director. This movie is really, really well made.
Yes.
It's a beautiful film. I think part of the reason I don't like it is I don't like spending time in that world. And I think it might, to your point about like your worldview and the nihilism possibly, like that's not my worldview. And yeah. So I was just like, and also I don't want to hang out in COVID era America. Like, I don't say it's a bad movie. I just don't like, I didn't want to spend time in that. And like literally, so Val had to pee at the end and she goes, I think I'm done. And just didn't come back inside. It was like 5 more minutes of the movie. And she's like, I was like, here's what happened. She goes, I don't care. Like, and she was just done. And I was kind of done too. And I was just like, man, I just didn't like being in that world. But I won't discount a lot of what you said. I think that like the performance is a great thing. Joaquin is one of his better performances.
The Darius Kanji, it's one of the two
gorgeous
movies that he shot this year that are absolutely like jaw-droppingly gorgeous.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's also not your type of thing beyond the worldview is that you don't like being made to feel uncomfortable.
That's true.
And not like you love horror movies and you love like darkness and everything, but what you don't like shit posting, and you don't like people who are there like trying to make you cringe.
Yep.
And that is this. This is like shit post the movie.
Well, Val literally earlier was like, oh, you want to watch the video that of that one time Ashley Simpson fucked up on SNL? And I jumped off the couch and ran to the other room.
Yeah.
And she started laughing. That's, you know me too. I'm like,
yeah, awkward. It makes you so uncomfortable.
Like Nathan, for you, awkward humor. I'm just like, I cover my fucking face, you know.
Which is funny because I don't like Nathan for You and some of that stuff too. But like this just totally works for me because it's like, I think it's getting at something.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? So your number three is
Sentimental Value.
Wow. We'll talk about like obvious picks.
I know. Well, we all watched it together with James on a double feature with No Other Choice, which was an awesome double feature.
Yeah.
Probably
shouldn't have watched the second. No Other Choice really like came out swinging.
If you would have flipped it, it would have been a much different experience, I think for you in particular. But yeah. I really, really love this movie. I think Trier is just an incredible filmmaker. And the main thing, too, is like, I mean, I'm Swedish-American and like, the Nordic melancholy of this movie is something I understand very well. And my family understands very well. I also just love the inside of like inside the home of an artist or like what that does and the effect. And obviously Skarsgård had said numerous times, he's pulling from his experience working with Bergman.
Right.
You know, who was kind of a monster. Like actually, you know, he was a monster in a lot of ways, but the cost that it has on everyone around you. And I really like the way it mixes, obviously, the reality of the movie they're making with the reality movie they're making with like the real world outside of it. And you have him not being able to really heal his relationship with his daughter, but doing that through his relationship with Elle Fanning inside the film. It's that beautiful scene where she's like, I don't think I can do this anymore.
Yeah.
And it's one of the best scenes of the year of him. And he holds her in this like really fatherly way, a way he can't do with his real daughter. It's this wonderful like, analog. And then you also have, I think one of my favorite scenes of the year is where the two sisters are just lying there next to each other in bed. And she confesses basically, the only reason I'm okay is because of you. Like, you were the one who kept this all together. There's just a lot of revelatory scenes in this movie.
Yeah.
And emotional beats that, I mean, I cried my eyes out in this movie. And I think also just, like, when you've grown up with a father who is very esteemed, which is my dad on a smaller scale, you know? Like, I very much understand that world of, like, mm-hmm. how it can kind of throw other relationships topsy-turvy, you know? And I think my brother and I were very close because when you're like somewhat in the shadow of someone, how it's hard to live in that.
Sure.
Yeah. I just think that the film hit me on a lot of emotional levels. And I just think he's an impeccable filmmaker.
Yeah, it's like, great. I need to revisit it because I didn't love it as much as I loved Worst Person in the World.
Right.
But I still think it's a pretty terrific film.
Yeah.
So my third pick is going to be Resurrection.
Which I've not seen yet.
I know, the Chinese film from Bai Gan.
I'm seeing it Friday.
And which a 3-hour surreal epic, you know, in which it takes kind of on a sci-fi journey about, you know, these people. There's two classes of people, those who can dream and those who cannot. And dreams are represented through cinema. And he basically walks you through almost the history of cinema just through the techniques that he's using. You know, there's a silent film stretch. There's a film noir stretch. There's my personal favorite, this dystopian sci-fi stretch that's almost like something out of Strange Days that includes like a point of view karaoke sequence in a club full of vampires. It's absolutely insane.
I'm very ready for that.
But then, you know, there's a futuristic stretch, and it's really tough to describe because it's a real experiential movie that's incredibly moving. Visually, one of the most striking things you'll see all year. Has a score by M83, which is just washes over you the entire time. And, yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those movies that I think as it rolls out, kind of like Secret Agent, but to an even greater degree, because at least Secret Agent has been in like draft houses and
right.
Neon has it. Like, this is Criterion and Janus releasing, putting it out. And like, it's really only going to play at like art houses. Like, here in Austin,
right.
It's only going to play at AFS.
Right.
And like, it's played in New York and LA. And this is going to be one of those that, like, I honestly don't think you're going to see the full appreciation for until Janus puts it out on like a Blu-ray and everybody can kind of get their hands on it, because like, it's going to be such a small release. But man, and it's also like, it's a daunting task, like trying to get somebody to sit down for a 3-hour Chinese movie that traverses the history of cinema. Like, you say that to someone and they look at you like, thanks professor, but I've got enough homework on my plate already.
Right.
But like, this, it really isn't. It's just such a joyous, entertaining film at the same time. Because there's also, I totally forgot the whole segment in the middle that's maybe one of the most emotionally affecting, is there's a whole sequence that's almost like his con artist movie about a guy and a little kid like teaching, you know, a mentor-mentee thing where he's teaching this little kid how to like swindle people.
Like a Paper Moon kind of.
Yeah, it's yeah. Awesome.
Hell yeah.
So like, yeah, Resurrection.
So I have another one following on that, another experiential film, which is Ephes.
Great movie.
And we had heard about it for a while from our friend James, and I finally sat down to watch it.
Because he saw it at Cannes?
He saw it at Cannes, I think, yeah. And was just like, guys, I think he texted us, like, guys, I saw a movie
yeah.
that's, like, made for you all.
And got one of the infamous texts that I used to get at, like, 4 a.m. whenever we worked at, like, BMD and Draft
right.
House together, where he would be like, I just saw your next favorite movie. It's an S&M gay serial killer film from France.
It's a knife, like, knife plus heart. Yeah.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I love James, is that he, like us, is very excited about film. And when
yes.
when he gives his stamp like that highly, I'm like, he's 99% right. Basically, he knows us both. And like, Ephes is, for those who haven't seen it, and it didn't get a huge release at all, but
Music Box, I think, is the
Music Box, and it's about basically the last day of a regional or like a local baseball diamond being open. And these guys who are of different ages, but it's kind of like almost like a local baseball league. And you're just with them for like 2 full hours. For the last game. And it's in real time. The lights start to, like, you see the sun start to set. And it is just this beautiful ode to like that way of living. And also, for me, again, we're talking about, I think it is a very much finger on the pulse of the way I personally feel about America right now. Just like we're losing that magic, you know, and I'm not, I'm trying to get too political here, but you're saying it's a political year. And I think this film is very political in that sense.
Oh yeah. Very much.
We're losing that. And also the beyond politics with AI and just technology of that kind of pastoral way of spending time with your friends for 3-4 hours, just at a diamond, no phones, and just experience and bullshitting and like in fighting and everything and living. And you have that, you know, the wonderful announcer character who I guess sadly passed away like right after they finished filming.
Wait, I thought the announcer was Frederick Wiseman, the documentarian. Like he does the interstitials, I believe. Are you talking about the actual announcer during the game?
Yes, sorry.
Okay, so the guy who does the interstitials, that's Frederick Wiseman.
No shit.
The legendary documentarian.
Oh, wow. But yeah, the guy who's there early. Sorry, not the announcer. He's the one taking score.
The stats guy? He died?
He died.
Oh, he's one of the best parts of the movie.
He's really kind of the heart of the movie. And the whole feeling of the film, and I recommend it to everyone. And also, like, you and I both like baseball films a lot, too, which we did a whole episode on it. And it captures that magic and that Americana of these guys choosing how they're going to spend their time. And they're all trying to hold on to something. And none of this is said. Like, it's all inherent in the film. Because most of it is just this, like, super realistic, quotidian, the way they're all talking to each other.
Well, and it's also, like, it pairs in a weird way well with Secret Agent, too, because it's about these guys trying to preserve this part of their own personal history before it's bulldozed and forgotten forever, except for by the people who were there and experienced it, you know? And
actually erased, like you said, with Secret Agent.
And, like, here, I'm actually shocked that our buddy James loved this movie, because the guy that this reminds me the most of is Linklater.
He's not 100%. A huge
Richard Linklater fan, and this really reminds me of especially his early movies like Slacker and Dazed and Confused, because this is like very much like Dazed and Confused. It's about the last day before the sun sets and a new part of your life begins. And like also like on top of Frederick Wiseman, you also have like he cast the one thug dude from like Uncut Gems is in there. Mm-hmm. And like it's just all these very lumpy, gnarled faces of like guys you would see on this baseball diamond. But like kind of at the beginning when you were talking about this too, is that like I've tried to sell other people on this movie, and even explaining what it is to people is kind of difficult, because like I was telling my one friend about it and I was like, yeah, it's about, you know, these two baseball teams. And he's like, oh, what do they, are they like professional or whatever? You're like, no, they're just guys. Like, it's just like a rec league team.
It's like almost like a beer league kind of thing.
And
he
kind of just like looks at you like, oh, so it's like a funny movie. And you're like, not really. Like, it's kind of sad. And like, you're just hanging out with these dudes. Like, there's funny stuff in it. And there's great little profound moments. Like the whole like monologue about combat and about how every day, you know, in your life is combat, and every interaction that you have and an emotional moment can be combat. And like, but that's the other thing to take it to your like political point, is that it's like, this is these guys's refuge from the everyday and like the terrible things that they, or even mundane things that they have to deal with at their jobs or with their wives or whatever. And like, this is their escape, and they're losing that part of themselves and thrown back into a world that's pretty cruel and harsh and takes these things away from you at a moment's notice.
Yeah, I mean, a way you could almost sell to people would be like an adult Sandlot. You know,
that's good. I didn't think about that.
You know, it is the sense of like, that's where those kids are, you know, and they're all like lower income. They're just like trying to survive, and they're just hiding out from the world. And in a very kind of Stephen King kind of loser's club, you know, kind of way. But this film has really floored me. And I think one of the reasons it is hard to explain is it just works on you.
Yeah.
Like you got to just, like you said, even though the other films sink into it. And once you're on its wavelength, like I've really never seen a film like this before.
I'm glad I saw it in a theater. I saw it in a theater a second time, because it really locks you in and puts you on that baseball diamond with these dudes. So my fourth pick is The Shrouds, David Cronenberg's. We were talking about late style earlier, the epitome of late style, movie about, frankly, him grieving his dead wife and how he moves forward with it. And with Vincent Cassel as an obvious stand-in for him, right down to having the same exact hair that Cronenberg has.
a step up from Crimes of the Future. He looks even more like him than Viggo does.
Yeah. And I mean, and Crimes of the Future, this plays as a interesting companion piece too, because there's a lot of that same melancholy in Crimes of the Future. And that's very much about an artist recognizing the women in his life and the partnership that's kind of gone forward and propelled him to continue to do these great things, even when he thinks he's kind of run out of gas. This is a movie about mourning those people after they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about a guy who creates technology that allows you to view your loved ones in the grave as they decompose. And then this conspiracy that occurs around him to where there's grave robbing and his technology is vandalized and he starts to spin out on the things that he thinks are happening. And like, I know that that's the major point of contention. Like our buddy James hated this movie.
Yeah, he thought it can as well.
Yeah, he thinks that like, I remember him coming back and telling me that he thought it was terrible. And that was the big thing, is that he's like, it starts really well and it starts very Cronenbergian, but then it spins out into this like conspiracy thing that's like super silly and whatever. And it is kind of silly and the movie's very funny, but the thing is, like, I think the conspiracies are there because like it almost becomes a stand-in for the ways that you try to explain the unexplainable. When like tragedy happens or people that you love are taken from you and you don't have any explanation except for the fact that like that's just how life is and sometimes you get unlucky, you try to put these things together that might not exist and piece these pieces of like narrative together that you essentially invent so that you have an explanation that feels concrete and tangible as opposed to just the ethereal nature of existence. And like, I get that that might not work for everybody and it is kind of clunky at times, but like, this is also pure Cronenberg and Cronenberg's my favorite filmmaker of all time.
Yep.
And like, if this is the last movie that we ever get from him, it's an incredible period to the end of it. Like in my mind, the most affecting cinematic career that I've ever experienced while being on this earth is that like this could be his last movie and I would be like, cool, you're good, you've said everything that you need to say now.
Yeah, the Crimes of the Future would have been a good period and this would as well. Like it's like you said, they pair really well together. I love this movie. We saw it together for the first time, and the one thing you can't forget that the story goes, it was going to be a TV series as well. And he did collapse a lot of this into a feature film, which I think is at fault for the clunkiness at the end. I don't mind it. I also think everything with Guy Pearce is super fucking fascinating. All the AI shit is really on the money.
Yeah.
Like, when he first did it, I was like, you know, there's times when elder statesman filmmakers try to deal with modern technology and they seem kind of old and out of touch. I've never felt that way with Cronenberg.
Well, except for it's not the technology. There's only one movie I've ever watched of his where it felt kind of out of touch.
Existence?
Maps of the Stars.
Oh, yeah. That,
it doesn't quite work because it feels like an old guy doing Hollywood satire that's maybe 10 years too late.
That's fair. But I would say on the tech
stuff, you're totally right.
He's always
prophetic.
He's always up on what's happening now, but also like where we're going. And also how that always leads to questions of identity, right? And
nobody's ever thought about this stuff in the way that he has for his 50 plus year career, like
right,
dating all the way back to like Videodrome and everything. Like he foresaw the way we're even addicted to screens 40 years later.
Yeah, and the idea too, yeah, that it's changing our bodies. Like what we're consuming is, and it is, like they've done studies, like it's changing our pathways. Like he's so great at also symbolizing that through body horror. But this film, I think the scene though, that the scenes that fucked me up the most are the number of scenes where his wife comes in over and over again, missing parts of her body.
And the sex scene where like her hip breaks like halfway through is like shockingly upsetting.
You and I both just like gasped watching that. And I started crying. I remember
Diane Kruger really good in this movie.
She's amazing. And like, you just see also Cronenberg bearing his fucking soul.
Yeah.
This movie feels like a confession to him, to us. I mean, that's how I felt watching it. And like,
well, I even read an interview with him where he was like, the impetus for the movie, what came from his wife's funeral, to where he remembers her getting buried and wanting to jump into the grave with her, not necessarily to die, but just because he wanted to still stay there with that person he wanted to be with.
Well, and just, you know, you have that wonderful opening scene of him trying to go on a date that's at his own restaurant where he has the cemetery out, the shrouds out back. Also, the shroud design is so fucking cool, Cronenberg. Like,
oh, God,
like,
yeah.
Again, like, even to your point, like, he's a filmmaker because he's, I mean, he's your favorite. He's, like, top three for me, you know, but, like, he's one of our cinematic gods. And, like, even if this movie sucked, which it doesn't, the elements of Cronenberg always pull me through.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, he...
Well, even when the effects are janky and weird, like the fluttering, weird, like, bug camera that's in the grave. Like, it looks wonky, but it's so him.
Yeah, you're like, I don't fucking care. Like, it doesn't take you out. So, yeah, great fucking film.
So, what's your last pick before we get to the shared list?
Dangerous Animals.
Oh my God, this movie's so fun.
Dude, we had the best fucking time seeing this in the theater. I think I went again. I think
you did?
Yeah, I went twice and I showed
it. I watched it on Shudder afterwards.
Yeah, I showed it to Val as well and she loved it. And like, okay, no surprise to our people who've listened for a while. Marty likes shark movies. Jacob loves shark movies, but I love a good shark movie. And this is one of the best I've seen. This is probably my favorite since 47 Meters Uncaged and then The Shallows. This is like up in probably my top five favorite shark movie because it's basically Wolf Creek on the water.
Yeah.
And you have Jai Courtney turning in one of the most fun fucking movie horror villains in a long time. Also, what a great year for Australian. You have this and Bring Her Back, and you have two really just Sally Hawkins and then very different characters, but just like it's all about how they hold the movie together. You know, for those who haven't seen it, it's basically about a serial killer who kidnaps mostly women off the beach and takes them out onto his trawler into shark infested waters and then videotapes them hanging over the water on like a winch and lowering them into shark water where they're eaten.
And there's actual shark photography in it. There's it's not actual all CGI and everything. The shark stuff looks awesome.
There is a shot of later in the film of the main character who's honestly the weakest part of the movie. She's good, but it's like she's like so attractive that you're just like you can't buy it. Like she looks like a model. She's also in Yellowstone, I think. But other people complain. Val did as well of like she just wasn't the best lead. She's like too cool, like too badass from the beginning. But they
almost try to do a Your Next type heroine with her.
100%. But she drops into the water with a great white. And there's this huge wide shot of her treading water, like underwater. And I think a real, she wasn't in there obviously, but a real shot of a great white and its gills just flutter. And it's just this amazingly like badass, like epic fucking shark scene. And like, it's just it's a tight fucking thriller too, because it's not, it's weird because it's not even a shark movie. It's like a serial killer film with sharks. Yeah. I would say like that's what he uses. It's a great, like, you know, scene because she's with this guy she slept with is looking for her. So he's kind of like the Loomis, like trying to track down where it's happening. It's a really good survival movie. And just great shark stuff. I mean, revolting kills.
Very, very violent.
Yes.
Sean Byrne, really good horror director.
Dude,
between this and The Loved Ones.
Loved Ones is like phenomenal.
Yeah, and I feel like the movie's forgotten at this point by a lot of people.
I rewatched it. That's also a very French New Extremity movie.
Yes.
It feels like it.
Once you get to the basement and what's in there, it's pretty nasty. All right, so my last pick before we get to our shared list is Den of Thieves 2 Pantera. This flies in the face of the whole, like, there weren't good movies all year because I believe this was...
February?
We saw it in the... No, January.
It was January.
I think it was the first release of the year.
It was like this week.
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But I've watched this movie probably 10 times since throughout the year. Watch it with our buddy James multiple times. He loves it. This is the Miami Vice to the original's Heat. Both like the dirtbag versions of those movies. Gerard Butler, never been better than when he's Big Nick. and putting him into the middle of this like Eurocrime sleek heist thriller that has more in common with like, you know, the great films of like the 60s and 70s that came out of France, as opposed to, you know, just ripping off more American action movies, right, is such a choice.
It's very Luc Besson as well.
Very Luc Besson. Europacore. Very Euro, Europacore, yep. Euro trash. But like sleekly directed. Christian Gutegast, like I hope he keeps making one of these like every couple years until he dies. And I mean, that ending car chase in the tunnel is, you know, still for me top five set pieces of the year. Like, it's just incredible.
It's, well, and the whole movie is just such a vibe.
Yeah.
Like, it really is. Because, like, I'm not the fan of these series that you are, but I love this movie. I had a great time. We were way too drunk.
Yeah, I had to see this twice because I blacked out during the first viewing.
We were over at Gibson, like, doing beers and shots.
Too many.
We had, like, 8 drinks for this movie. I was like, what's going on?
Then we kept drinking during the movie. I went back and watched it again, like, 2 days later, and I was like, there's a whole section of this I don't remember. I just remember loving it.
We had a good time.
But it's, you know, the chemistry between Gerard Butler and O'Shea Jackson Jr. is, yep, like, off the charts. The whole, like, clan of, like, you know, Euro sleaze, like,
yeah,
heist dudes that they come up with are awesome. Like, I love this movie. I think it's gone. It's kind of flown under the radar now because it came out so early in the year.
Yeah.
But like, if you threw on Den of Thieves 2 again right now, I would watch it front to back. Love it.
I know you would.
So we're going to get to our shared list now. And this is kind of the unified best top five of the year for us that we,
right,
were just like, I guess also not only was this ripping off somebody else's format, but it was also like we were texting back and forth and we kept throwing titles out. We were both like, because originally we were just going to do 5 and 5,
right,
like usual. But we would be like, so one battle after another. And you're like, yeah, and it's like Marty Supreme. It's like, oh, shit, who's going to take that one? And who's going to take this? And it's like, okay, we just need all these. So this is, I believe, our shared top five, and we're going to start with F1.
Yes.
A movie we saw together.
You saw IMAX. It before, and then I saw it again. Yeah.
I saw it at an influencer screening, which was insane, because I almost got into a fight with an F1 fan because his girlfriend wouldn't stop Googling what they were going to get for dinner afterwards, so I finally started kicking their seat. and he, like, stood up like he was going to do something, and he saw me, and he was like, oh.
Yep.
But then this movie just rips. Like, and especially seeing it in Bob Bullock IMAX twice.
God.
It's overwhelming. The sound, it puts you in those cars, it gets you going that fast. The technology that they revolutionized to make this movie is incredible. And it pairs incredibly well with Top Gun Maverick. And also, like, it's the one thing that we both said coming out of it is that this is one of the few, again, like Top Gun Maverick, is that so many directors since the 90s have tried to replicate that Tony Scott, Jerry Bruckheimer,
yeah, Michael Bay
style, yeah, of like 90s action filmmaking. Kaczynski is the only one who, for me, just nails it.
Yep.
You know, and this is another example of that. It's the Days of Thunder to Maverick's Top Gun.
Yeah, there's a tone to his stuff that he, it's hard to even put into words, but he totally gets on the wavelength of a Tony Scott, because
there's no irony.
It's not meta. It's not wink at the audience. It's not the J.J. Abrams fucking Joss Whedon.
It's very sincere.
Wackety schmackety do shit. This is like, well, and for me, and you know, I'm a huge Steve McQueen fan, and so is Brad Pitt, and like, he's just doing Steve McQueen.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, even a couple of his outfits are literally, I've seen photos of McQueen wearing the same thing in like the 60s. Like, he goes all in.
There are so many shots in this movie. Oh. Like, there are so few people right now who are as good at just simply photographing movie stars,
yep,
as Kaczynski. And so much of this movie is just like, it almost feels like Brad Pitt walked into wardrobe and was like, see that shit? That shit looks cool. Now you're going to shoot me in it and I'm going to look awesome.
Well, the scene, like, there's, yeah, there, I know a couple of shots you're talking about, but like the one, There's two times where he like comes, walks on
The actual track, and he's just wearing the fucking dopest shit ever.
He's got badass jeans, and he's just like, the first time he's like, they ask him to come at Bardem, also top level Bardem in this movie.
Oh my God.
Pure movie star charm. He invites him to come race for his team, and he just, everyone looks down the track, and you just see this fucking beautiful, beefy man just strutting, full movie star energy. But it's also funny, like, it's like they know there's a joke in that too, of like,
when this he comes, a Gucci suit,
yeah, it's a Gucci suit, you know. It's fucking well, and again to your point, the way that they film the race is like, I went deep on this after the movie came out, of like, they were embedded during the F1 season. They filmed this during real F1 races that people watched on TV, and Brad Pitt was there.
Well, it's why all the drivers are in it. It's why it has one of the biggest drivers of all time as a major consultant on it.
Yep.
Like, it's just,
Lewis Hamilton, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, dude, if we're going to be honest, Top Gun Maverick's the better movie, but here's my weird theory about F1, is that F1 might be actually the better Top Gun movie, because in the same way that people, you know, when Top Gun came out, there was always the big talking point of like, you know, enrollments in the Navy were never higher because Top Gun was the greatest commercial you could ever have for joining the Air Force, right, and joining the Navy. I mean, in the same way, I think F1's a better Top Gun movie than Top Gun Maverick, in the fact that it plays as a bona fide commercial for F1, because like, instantly after, like, our buddy James just started watching Drive to Survive, like, front to back.
Yeah.
And like, this movie's done so well overseas internationally in terms of like its box office, has become one of the biggest hits of the year. And I wonder how many people have just been turned on to F1 after seeing this who would never watch that sport otherwise.
Well, yeah, you're right, because it's a branded movie.
Like, yeah, the title, F1, the movie.
The title is F1. It's not like a movie in F1. It's like they literally have the branding and the logo.
Yeah.
Is your movie.
And I guess, you know, you could make the argument that that's bad for actual cinema, is that you're making a giant commercial. But if it rips as hard as this fucking movie does, who gives a shit, dude?
Do you know what it weirdly reminds me of in that way? Was the whole series of The Hire with fucking Colin Clive Owen.
Right.
The BMW thing, it's like the kind of similar mentality, but drawn out into
when they would get Tony Scott and John Woo and all these guys to come in.
Carnahan.
Yeah. And also, I mean, Kerry Condon, marry me.
Yep. Yeah. And it's just Pitt full charm mode too. I mean, like he and Bardem have the best chemistry. Like, he's cool as hell in the whole movie. And also, like,
it's not really a performance.
No, and also, I listen to the soundtrack every day. The F1, the Hans Zimmer score
rips.
Well, also brings you into classic Tony Scott. You know, like, because I was rewatching Days of Thunder after this, and like, a lot of the cues and the way like it will come down is he listened to his own soundtrack for Days of Thunder and did it again.
Also, like, does the old school 80s thing of like getting pop music written for the actual score and then integrating some of those songs into the actual soundtrack or into the actual score itself.
The, like, Doja Cat scene?
Yeah, it fucking is awesome. Fuck. All the split screen stuff is great. Oh. And I know a lot of people are like, these songs aren't great. You would never listen to them outside of the movie. Yeah, that's the point, you fucking morons.
Yeah, come on.
Like, it's just awesome.
It's such a fucking movie.
Number four is 28 Years Later.
Oh, yeah.
Another movie I blacked out during.
You did.
You know, the first time. We got entirely too drunk at Gibson Street again. Because the first time we watched this, I was kind of on the fence about it. And then I rewatched it again, sober. And was like, this movie is one of the most emotionally draining experiences of the year. It's incredibly good. Maybe Garland's best script ever. And a return to form for Danny Boyle, who's just proves again that when he turns it on, man, he's one of the best to ever do it.
There are so many scenes this year in many films where I literally jumped out of my seat. Like, I felt I was lifting out of my seat. And one of those is a film coming up we're going to talk about next. Many scenes there. F1 had a lot of that during the racing scenes. And for me, the action scenes with the bow and arrow early on in this film are some
really
of the,
terrific.
Are some of the coolest fucking, and it's like, coolest things I've ever seen. And I love, you know, that he goes back to shooting on iPhone, Well, he shoots on iPhone to give you a very similar, like, the digital artifacting of the original.
Right.
But it works because it's like our eyes are now trained for this new type of digital photography. But, you know, these rigs that he built, these huge, like, 25 iPhone rigs to kind of do, like, bullet time. In a way where it would, like, cut.
It's crazy.
But he would cut across, so it's like the arrow hits are just, like, so. And I was sitting there, because I was a lot more sober than you were, and I was, like, lifting out of my seat. I was so excited. And I didn't think he could pull it off. I didn't think Garland could pull it off to throw us back into this world in such a fascinating way. And my buddy Yvonne, my writing partners, he started, he goes, it really wasn't for me. I was like, dude, you didn't finish it? And then he texted me. He's like, dude, thank you so much for telling me to finish it. Because Ralph Fiennes is just the giant fucking cherry on top of this movie.
Oh, my God. One of the best performances of the year. And, like, a guy who just comes in off the bench late in the movie and gives you... I mean, for me, still the most emotionally, like, sincere moment of the entire year. Like, helping a because the movie is... probably one of Garland's best scripts, because not only is it about Brexit and it's about, you know, nationalism and pride in one's own nation and everything and the poisonous kind of nature of that, but it's also about what we take as children from our father versus what we take from our mother.
Yep.
And how we mythologize both, and then how we also see them as real people. And it becomes about a kid on the journey to with his mother before she dies and accepting death. And the, you know, the ritual that Ralph Fiennes puts him through, you know, the memento mori scene is like one of the most moving things you'll see all year. And also, like, not only is the Anthony Dodd Mantle cinematography incredible on that like causeway.
Oh my God. Chase, oh, that scene, when dude.
It becomes incredibly cosmic, but the young father's score is as good as anything, you know, from the entire year. It's really, really terrific.
It's a really beautiful film, and it just keeps, like, there's just so many shots in this film where you can see Boyle, like, going for broke. Like, it's the least lazy movie. He just completely leans into it. And, like, I love your idea too about you have this kid who's, like, really seeing his father for the first time. Because it's like, we also cast this very handsome movie star, Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Yep.
And we're all like, oh, this is our hero. This is like our Joel from fucking, you know, Last of Us. Like a badass. And then it's kind of just starts to take that apart.
It chips away at his image.
Yeah, and the way we tell these, like you said, these stories. And then everything with his mother and the whole action scene with, like, the Swedish soldier. And, like, there's just some amazing set pieces, too. And... Danny Boyle is on fire. It's such an amazing film. And I'm really excited for Bone Temple in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Number three, I mean, here's the thing. So our top three is probably going to be the majority of people's top three for the year.
Right.
To be honest. But I think that speaks to how strong these films are, is that these are almost like instant classics that right. came out. And the fact that we got three of them is insane. Number three is Sinners.
Oh, my God.
Ryan Coogler's vampire prohibition.
Walter era, Hill.
Walter Hill movie with a killer twin performance from Michael B. Jordan about, you know, black gangsters who come back home to the South to create their own juke joint. I mean, a lot has already been said about this movie. We've talked about this movie a bunch. And, like, it's just, you know, when all is said and done, we have two movies ranked ahead of this film. But there's an argument that Sinners is the movie of 2025. There's no bigger cultural event that occurred at the movies right. than this. Like, it literally, like, everybody got brought together and had to have an opinion on this film.
My dad watched it.
That's what I mean.
He doesn't see anything.
And it's like it's one of those films that, like, you don't get this that often anymore. Nothing. There is no monoculture in 2025, right. or there often isn't a monoculture. And this is one of the rare times we actually, everybody, you know, back in the day, what we used to call water cooler movies is that you would just come back and see it and be like, did you see Sinners this weekend? It's fucking awesome.
Well, it's just such a unique movie, and it's so propulsive. Like, it moves like music. Like, yeah. The opening scene where he comes into town, and he's talking to the shop owners and getting the catfish and everything. And it's just these long, like, almost like Scorsese or even, like, P.T. Anderson, PTA shots of, like, following her across to get her daughter. And the daughter goes to get the mom, and they're going to have the sign painted. And it's just... The movie
shot it on 65 millimeter and stuff too.
Yeah, well, there's a moment, and you had already seen it. We went to Bullock to see it at your second time, and I think you looked over at me, and it's when it's. I mean, the scene of the movie in my for this couple, but the number one is the time travel one where
they pierce the veil.
They pierce the veil, and you literally see all these people and their cultures, and the future and the past all mixed together. And because until that point, there's none of that. Like, it is very, like, it's a reality-based film. And I lost my fucking mind. Like, you said, Martin, you literally, like, you were standing up in your seat. Like, I saw your butt, like, lean. Yeah. I was, like, leaning forward toward the theater, toward the screen. And then it's the shot where the vampires finally are going to be let in. And it moves from... you know, the standard aspect ratio to full IMAX, and you literally see the screen expand, and we're like, oh, here we fucking go. And that scene is awesome. And also just like, why am I blanking on his name? The
Jack O'Connell.
Yeah. And Jack O'Connell is like, it's so amazing in this film, because I also love the theme too. If we're talking about a very political film of similar to Get Out, the promise of being assimilated,
right?
You know, it's like, hey, like, no, we believe in equality, but also we're gonna, or basically another movie about erasure, right? We're going to erase your culture, make almost like the Borg, like you will be part of the collective. Similar to what we talk about with Pluribus, they're all kind of dealing with this kind of theme, right?
Well, it's all about, you know, preserving your individuality and your cultural individuality versus being gentrified, more or less.
Right.
And like
the
Irish vampires coming in and, you know, trying to take black music from these people and Miles Canton's character. Like, because there's a reason why the movie is based in reality the entire time. And then literally you have the scene where he pierces the veil, and almost the very next scene is the vampire dropping out of the sky.
Yep.
You know, and like, that's when you see them and then coming for them, you know. But Ludwig Göransson's score,
oh my God,
what he writes for this is incredible. But like, the way the movie also positions Remick, Jack O'Connell's character, as the... I hate to compare him to Thanos, but it's like the way that when people would talk about the Avengers movies and the whole like Thanos was right argument of like, it gives you an actual villain who, like, when he presents his case for why you should become a vampire, why you should live forever, why you should give some of your music over to us and we'll share it. It's not the worst argument in the world. Is that he argues that, like, and also rooting it, because Ryan Coogler's been very candid in interviews and stuff about his research into, you know, Irish music and Irish history and everything, and that he made the vampires Irish for a reason, is that they're also an oppressed people.
Right.
And it's saying that, like, we've experienced oppression too, even though we might be white, you can come with us and, like, we can join together, because otherwise you're just going to get killed tomorrow morning when the KKK shows up anyway.
Right.
Like, we know that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So like,
which is a really fascinating story element.
Exactly.
To the film.
And it like, it adds this layer of like, did they do the right thing or not in preserving their own cultural heritage too? And like, it's just, it's a very rich text that like, it's also the movie that, when talking about it, frankly, I hate to sound condescending, but with normal people who aren't like cinephile freaks like us, when they go, oh, I watched Sinners, it was pretty cool, but like, you know, it's kind of just like From Dusk Till Dawn, or like, it, you know, it's a vampire movie. I don't really get like the big deal with it. And then you sit there and you're like, there's so much going on under the hood of this movie if you take 5 seconds to think about it. But most people don't care to. But the simple fact is that even then, nobody has been like, well, I didn't think there was enough going on, but they're still like, it was pretty cool. You know, they just don't love it in this, to the same degree. But no one out and out comes back and goes, this movie sucks. Like, even nobody. If you just watch it on a pure entertainment level, it rips.
Yeah, it's, well, that's the thing, too. I think, you know, beyond the thematic elements, like, it is such a most amazingly made film.
Yeah, like, it looks incredible.
It just looks incredible. Like, it moves. It has this, again, propulsive feel to it. And I remember seeing it.
The musical sequences are insane.
Well, yeah, the scene where he's like, go, Lassie, go, and everything with Hayley Steinfeld. And also another thing to unpack, too, she's a person passing. You know, she's a half, I think, quarter or half black. And it's this whole thing of, like, she's the one who's able to go out and speak to them. And then she's sent as, like, the ambassador to infect, you know. It's just, there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot you can take from it. But also, like, you could turn all that off in your brain and just let the film take you over. And
also, the movie has two fucking killer endings.
Yeah.
And that, well, three, technically. And that you have the vampire showdown. And then I think you have the more cathartic moment of when, you know, the one brother goes out and murders the entire KKK. Yeah,
it's the Tarantino.
Yeah, it is totally the Inglourious Basterds moment. And then it has the post-credit scene, which is the most moving.
With Buddy Guy.
Yeah, the moment in the entire film is when he laments, you know, the last time they ever saw his brother in the sunlight. Like, it's, I think this movie is tremendous. Again, the top three for me are almost interchangeable.
Right.
As I love them all. I think I prefer one over the other, but like this is going to be three movies right in a row, which again, we're so blessed to have this, is that every time you sit down with each one, you go, well, this is the best movie of the year.
Well, and it's two from fucking Warner Brothers. Like, you know, like really incredible stuff.
So number two, I've got Marty Supreme.
Oh, yes.
Which is probably my number one, if we're being honest. Yep. Like, number one and number two are the ones that were flip-flopping the most, with Sinners jockeying for, like, that last place. Right. But Marty Supreme is, like, you know, we got two Safdie Brothers movies this year, and we kind of figured out which one has the juice and which one doesn't behind the camera. Not that I liked Smashing Machine more than you did, but I still think it's very slight, and there's not a whole lot of meat on that bone, besides The Rock's performance, which is quite good.
Yeah.
But Marty Supreme is just, it's in the same vein as, you know, Uncut Gems and Good Time.
Yeah.
And like even stretching back to, you know, their earliest very micro budget movies like The Pleasure of Being Robbed. It's both a sports period epic with Jack Fisk production design and Darius Kanji cinematography. And it's a run all night, you know, sweaty palmed, after hours, king of comedy, like New York grunge movie that's totally my shit.
Oh, it's so your shit.
And features Abel Ferrara in a heavy role and like grumbling and threatening to hit a pregnant woman in the stomach with a hammer. And like,
I remember seeing it the first time with you and James, and we were also, it was our first time for all of us. And I love this movie. I think it's fantastic. But the whole time was like, this movie's made for Jacob. I've never seen a more Jacob-coded movie in a long time.
Yeah.
When Ferrara shows up, I was like, well, this just tipped it over into the most Jacob movie. Like,
and he's given like actual lines and like a role to play.
He's terrifying. Like, well, and the
he's
moment
a goblin.
Well, the moment, because it you say it's a run all night movie, but that really doesn't start until it's the moment the movie switches is the bathtub. Like, that's where the movie enters like Safdie. Then he's just like lying,
can happen.
Just lying to get out of a situation that going all the way down into hell.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think like, again, a year for movie stars, you know, Chalamet for playing a really, honestly, a piece of shit. Like in a
massive dirtbag.
Massive dirtbag. But you still are rooting for him in, again, that very Safdie way, right? Of just like, he's our guy.
It's the thing that it's that they've done now, and specifically more Josh Safdie and Ronald Bronstein, who has co-written all of these movies and co-edited these movies, including this one, is that they take a movie star Timothée Chalamet, Adam Sandler, right. Robert Pattinson, and they make them absolute scumbags.
And ugly.
And ugly. Yeah. But they know that that gravitas that they possess is going to put you on their side automatically. You are going to want to run all night with Robert Pattinson, even if he does have sex with an underage teenage girl. You are going to run all night with Adam Sandler, despite the fact that he's cheating on his entire family with Julia Fox. You are going to run all night with Timothée Chalamet, despite the fact that he's leaving his pregnant girlfriend behind while he yep. goes overseas to play ping pong and then almost denies the baby at first. Like, it's an incredible turn that they just know the power of movie star charisma.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for me, too, like, the fact that he shoots the... Some people were ripping on it. It's not a sports movie. Like, yeah, it's not a sports movie. Like, it's not supposed to be.
I think it is.
You know...
The sports stuff is so riveting.
But that's the thing. It's amazing, but I don't...
And it really ends on a very traditional Rocky note.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's what's really special about the film is the final duel with the Japanese ping pong player where... You know, you had this, Marty is, thematically, he's dancing between his actually true love, which is ping pong, and his true love of, and he has a sense of honor there, right? Of like, I want to do this right. He's not a cheater. He does it real. He's like, I'm the best. But he's selling himself out. He's basically taking a fall for money. And to have that moment where he's like, I don't care about the money. I actually care more about ping pong and about playing and then showing my true skill. And I love that we talked about it. It kind of reminded me a lot of Red Belt. And also you have Mammoth in the movie. Like, Mammoth's in this movie. There's definitely a Mammoth elements to the Safdies
oh, sure.
as well. But you have that moment of him, you know, it's like the real fight is not the real fight. Like, he's not going to go be in the actual tournament, but he's going to give everything he has. And like you said, like Rocky, right? It's like, this is an exhibition fight. This is not for the heavyweight championship.
He finds out he's not invited to the tournament anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So he's that very similar. So it's pulling on a lot of great, to your point, a lot of great, like, kind of classic sports movies.
Also gives you one of the great villains of the year in Kevin O'Leary.
Oh, my God.
A guy who probably shouldn't be a villain, but he's honestly pushed to that position because Marty's such a shithead to him the yep. entire time. So he finally wants to take revenge on this little asshole. But, like, he has the great movie speech of the year for me of, I was born in 1601. I'm a vampire. I've been around for decades. I've met many Marty Mousers. Some have succeeded, some haven't, but you will never be happy. You will never be happy if you win that game. And it's just like, that moment is the one where I almost like sprung out of my chair and was like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen. Like, O'Leary, and obviously controversial figure. A lot of people are pissed off he's even in the movie.
Right.
He's fucking awesome in this. And apparently he came up with that speech on the day.
Oh my God.
Like, he was mad because they said Milton wasn't given enough to do in the audience. And he went up and he talked to Ronald Bronstein and he was like, you know what? I hate this guy. Like, he's going to damage my company. He's going to do all this. I should say something. I'm a fucking vampire. I was born in 1601. And apparently Ronald Bronstein looked at him and was like, that's fucking sick. And just put it in the movie.
Oh, it's so
like,
good.
But that's also the thing of like, it shows you how the Safdies, Josh Safdie and Ronald Bronstein work, is that there is that sense of spontaneity and collaboration. Mm. And also just the way that they find these faces, like having George Gervin show up as like the ping pong owner, you know, the famous basketball yeah. player. Having that guy, what was his name? Ted Williams, the man with the golden voice, also be in the cage of there.
Yep.
He was that homeless dude. Gwyneth Paltrow playing an aged out movie star who's trying to like get back in the game. Like, there's a metatextual element to that. Abel Ferrara as like this legendary New York dirtbag, just like showing up in goblin mode, you know, and being one of the other big villains of the movie. Penn Jillette showing up as like this destitute farmer who might have stolen a dog. And then Fran Drescher as the Jewish mother.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like, it's just, they know how to cast these movies. And Tyler, the Creator, like,
so good.
Like, really turning in an awesome performance as like Marty's hustler buddy. Like, I love this movie front to back. I've seen it 4 times already. I can't wait to see it like 40 more. Like when this comes out on VOD, it's going to be one of those things where I'm just playing on a loop at all times. Well, I was the same way with Uncut Gems though when it came out. I just loved that movie so much.
Well, it is interesting that our top 3 films all have a very similar energy to them. Yeah. They are just a heartbeat, like a bump, and it's just a rhythm to all 3. They just fly by, and there's just a completely enveloping nature. They're just cinema with a capital C.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, it just sucks you into that world.
Truly incredible stuff. Last but not least, number one. I mean, one battle after another.
Oh my God.
Paul Thomas Anderson. I guess let's start since so much has been said about this movie already. We've talked about how much we love it. I've seen it 7 times at this point. I literally saw it 4 times in its opening week in theaters. Yeah. I never do that. But it's just, I think, one of the stone masterpieces of the last 10, 20 years. Is this Paul Thomas Anderson's best movie?
It's my favorite.
Yeah. Well, because you're not as big of a PTA guy as I am.
I'm not. And this movie blew me the fuck away. Like,
yeah. And it's got a true movie star performance from Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, and also another movie that, to your point, kind of like Sinners, turns on a dime to where the intro to this movie promises a much different tone.
Yes.
Than what the actual bulk of the film is, which is kind of like a bumbling stoner run all night comedy.
Yep.
Where that still never, it never loses any of the tension or the stakes or anything. But the first 40 minutes are like classic PTA weird guy gets into this scenario that he might not belong in, becomes a part of this world, falls in love, and then loses this girl and is haunted for the rest of the movie by the specter of Perfidia Beverly Hills, where like Tiana Taylor, man, I mean, if there's somebody to be haunted by, it's her. Like, and
she's incendiary
of the movie.
No, because she's gone for most of it, but that doesn't matter. Like, she is just hanging over the movie. And I thought what was really amazing was just the questions it raises of, like, what are we leaving our children? Just seems to be the big theme.
Yeah.
You know, and again, we don't have kids, but we're old enough to have kids. You know, then what's the next generation have to look forward to?
I mean, Leo's basically playing my brother. Like, he's not far off. Girl dad, a stoner.
Yeah.
Has very leftist politics. Like even when I texted that to my brother and he finally watched it like a couple weeks ago. He's like, damn, you were right. This is me.
Well, it is interesting, though. I think we talked about it because we saw it together for the first time in the 70mm.
Yeah.
Because you hadn't seen that. It was our first time.
No, I saw it the night before.
Oh, right, yeah. So that was my first time. And then I got to see it at the Vista in LA with Tarantino there in VistaVision, which was like, that was like going to church. Like, that was amazing to see it, you know, in that style.
And you said it was radically different seeing it in that aspect ratio.
Yep. Yeah. It really was like, it was special. And I think it was just obviously like being in LA, being at the Vista, like, Tarantino walks by. I felt like it was kind of like a moment, you know, and then to see that movie, and I'd already seen it, but it's, I think it plays even better on a second or third viewing once it really sinks in. But
I mean, it's also like a lot of his movies too, is that like you pick up on the different rhythms as you go along and revisit them time and again. And honestly, it's the closest for me, at least, to Boogie Nights in terms of like, it's just fucking funny.
Yeah.
Like it's the closest to a straight comedy that he's made in like the longest time, I guess, outside of like Licorice Pizza has a lot of comedy to it, but like,
or Punch Drunk maybe. Yeah.
Punch Drunk is still, I know a lot of people find that movie funny. I find it harrowing to sit through because he's such an anxious, angry person. But like, for me, it's like, I sunk into this and laugh at it the same way that I laugh at, like, you know, Dirk Diggler and them doing all the fake movies and everything, and like Reed Rothschild doing the karate and like the magic and everything, and like where you just find these characters so endearing on like individual levels, and they all are given these like small moments that are funny. Like Benicio del Toro in this is my favorite character of the entire year. If I could model the rest of my life to be like Sensei, I would, because he's just the guy that, like, you know, is steadfast the entire time and keeps his head, and it's just like, just ocean waves, Bob. Ocean waves.
Well, there's so many scenes in this film too that are just like, just all the money on the table, like just showstoppers. And for me, it's there's the oneer with from inside the car, the skateboarders come up, grab on, talk to Sensei, and then go off.
Oh my god!
Or just the shots on the fucking roof, the skateboarders parkouring with the low sun, like the kind of purple light behind them, is just like. I was watching, like, whole, what the fuck am I watching? And then...
Also, when he falls off that fucking roof, yep. That looks like Leo.
No, it's insane. Well, that whole sequence, everything, once they go from Sensei to, we got a Latino Harriet Tubman situation going on, is fucking, you know, how he's meeting everyone, get off the fucking phone, and then introducing it to everyone, and then...
I'm not on the phone, man!
And him trying to charge his phone, and it also feels very Safdie. You know, it's just that, like... Fuck, I just got to get my phone charged, you know?
Well, it's like Paul Thomas Anderson cited Midnight Run as one of the movies that inspired this. And after you hear that and you watch it again and you go, oh, yeah, because you have the whole Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro energy with Leo and Benicio Del Toro of just like these two like goofballs, one who's just very stoic and straight ahead and the other one who's kind of like a character the entire time. But, like, also, Leo in this is, like...
Oh, my God.
It's... Since Wolf of Wall Street, I've always said that, like, he's one of our great comedic performers. He's just not often given enough to do. And this finds a middle ground between... It's probably closer to Rick Dalton in tone, and especially as he gets older with the jowls and everything and, like, just a certain look. But, like... It's right between Rick Dalton and Jordan Belfort because, like, he's asked to do a lot of weird physical stuff like he is in Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah. And he's just fucking funny. Like, the phone calls, this has the best phone acting maybe of all time.
And he's always been a good phone actor.
Yeah.
It's kind of been his thing, yelling at phones.
Again, Wolf of Wall Street.
Yep. Or honestly, Body of Lies is the one where he's just yelling at Russell Crowe.
Oh, yeah.
Just, like, the whole time.
Screaming the entire
calling
time.
Calling him a fat fuck.
But, it's man, like... when he keeps... The multiple calls back in to the Resistance headquarters.
Oh my God.
Is like the showstopper of the entire thing. When he just keeps. Comrade Josh. What kind of fucking name even is that? Get a better name, Josh.
Oh my God. That's. There's just. And then it's the obviously the car chase at the end is just insane. Like everything with the rising. You know, California, wherever they are.
The hills.
The shot, too, of the Native American tracker, the wide of their cars with that giant rock wall behind them. That on Vista and that. Just, like, there's certain stuff. Like, John Ford, man. It's fucking crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, and also we haven't even gotten to Sean Penn.
Oh, my God.
His weird RFK Jr.-coded villain coming after them. Stephen Lockjaw, one of the great performances of the year. I mean, and even, like, some of the strange little bits of casting, like having Jim Downey come back.
Oh, he's so funny.
And deliver his little lines. What was it? Haters, and, punk trash.
Yeah, and punk, yeah, punk trash. Or, semen demon.
Yeah. she was a sperm thief. A semen demon.
A semen demon. Like, he...
And it's just, it's an impeccably cast, impeccably performed, shot. No movie's better directed. The entire year.
Right.
Like, it's just, it's absolutely terrific. It's what you want our blockbuster entertainments to be. And it's also ragingly political. And obviously, that's the big debate about the movie now is it, whether or not it's political enough or Paul Thomas Anderson is committed to those a certain breed of politics. But, like, it's what you said is that it's more concerned with what we leave our children and. Maybe the lack thereof of what we're leaving our children and what the world is looking like going forward, you know, in response to what the actual world looks like right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just that final, and then the needle drop of American Girl is just an all timer. Like he's the best of needle drops and the Steely Dan needle drop earlier on.
Oh my God.
Too.
When you meet Chase Infinity for the first time,
it's her. She's amazing.
Yeah. What a find, man.
I mean, she just pops off the screen. She's just like you're totally,
she's beautiful. She can hold her fucking own against both Leo and Sean Penn.
Yeah.
It's just a tremendous, tremendous first time. Well, I guess not first time performance because she's been in stuff. She was in like Presumed Innocent.
Yeah.
Stuff.
But this kind of jump
first, like elevation of a performer. Well, Martin, that's 2025.
Dude, what we're looking at for 2026, probably another good one from everything we're seeing coming out. Even in January, just to get us started right.
I can't wait. I mean, it might become a TV podcast, though, because we've got The Pit and Industry coming out, too. So that's going to dominate a lot of our space. But I do know that this is a great way to sign off for 2025. We have some Killer Monkeys coming for you.
Oh, I'm so excited.
It's probably going to be a couple weeks into the new year before you get a new Secret Handshake. But, you know, stick with us. We're coming back, and we're going to deliver even more hours of conversation for you.
Well, I'm thankful for you all listening, too. It's been a great year.
Exactly, man. So stay tuned.
See you next time.
Bye. We'll be right back.
This is what you want. This is what you get.